quarter of the way through the chapter, you'll recognize where we are when we begin. Okay, listen, as I read, this is from the Message translation of the Bible. Here we go. God spoke. Swarm, ocean, with fish and all sea life. Birds, fly through the sky over earth. God created the huge whales, all the swarms of life in the waters, and every kind and species of flying birds. God saw that it was good. God blessed them. Prosper, reproduce, fill ocean. Birds, reproduce on earth. It was evening. It was morning. Day 5. God spoke, earth, generate life, every sort and kind, cattle and reptiles and wild animals, all kinds. And there it was, wild animals of every kind, cattle of all kinds, every sort of reptile and bug. God saw that it was good. God spoke, let us make human beings in our image, make them reflecting our nature, so they can be responsible for the fish in the sea, the birds in the air, the cattle, and yes, earth itself, and every animal that moves on the face of the earth. God created human beings. He created them godlike, reflecting God's nature. He created them male and female. God blessed them. Prosper, reproduce, fill earth, take charge. Be responsible for fish in the sea and birds in the air, for every living thing that moves on the face of the earth. Then God said, I've given you every sort of seed-bearing plant on earth and every kind of fruit-bearing tree, given them to you for food. To all animals and birds, to everything that moves and breathes, I give whatever grows out of the ground for food. And there it was. And God looked over everything that had been made. It was good, so very good. It was evening, it was morning, day 6. There's a lot of wisdom that resides in this poem that begins our story. This is how we start telling the story of God. This is how we start telling the story of people. And for generations, people who have told it and retold it have accessed a wisdom about who God is and about who we are. We are made by God. Now, I am not unaware of the raging debate that goes on among Christian people, some of whom say that evolution contradicts religion, and some of whom say that it doesn't. And that is not my fight. I really don't care. But I do have this to say about how we interpret the Bible. The interpretation of the Bible depends very much on the form in which the passage is presented. In any Bible that you have today, you will notice that this first chapter of Genesis is arranged according to poetic verse and in poetic line, which means that it is an ancient poem, and it is ancient Hebrew poetry. It doesn't rhyme like we would think of poetry rhyming, but that's because we live in a different society with different poetic norms, but it was the poetic form of the time. A story that was passed through oral tradition for a long, long time until finally it was written down. And so, it being a poem, I submit to you that the author's purpose was never to present to us a scientific journal about the origins of life, but instead, it was rather to give out the wisdom that is poet's expertise. The purpose for poetry is to disseminate wisdom more than it is to talk about the same kind of content that prose does. Wisdom like this, for example. No matter how we got here, God has given us responsibility for the earth. how in the world Christian people came to not be the leading environmentalists of our day is boggling to us, because right there at the very beginning of our story it says, prosper, reproduce, fill the earth, take charge. Be responsible for the fish in the sea. Be responsible for the birds in the air, for every living thing that moves on the face of the earth. How did we miss that? How did it not become to us that this is our role? This is the kind of wisdom that poetry offers us. The wisdom that no matter how we got here, God has vested the divine image equally in males and females. How Christian people came to be the enforcers of paternalism throughout history is boggling. Because right there at the beginning of our book, it says God created human beings. God created them godlike. Reflecting God's nature, he created them male and female. And yet, throughout history, we have made the male the priest. We have made the male the arbiter of God's voice. We have made the male the voice of God, when clearly the masculine and the feminine are equally the nature of God. These are the kinds of things that poetic literature tries to offer to us as wisdom and understanding. The fight over evolution seems to me to be a tempest in a teapot. No matter which side you come on, why are we fighting about it? I don't understand why so many of us have made this the hill that we are going to defend to the death. If God used evolution to create us, I can't see how that threatens our religion. If God spoke and poof, we were created, I can't see how that bolsters our religion. How does it help or hurt us how we came to be humans? Now, I know that there's a great deal of vitriol and spleen venting that erupts whenever this subject is broached. And I hope that doesn't happen, but because there's so much hoopla around this passage of Scripture, any preacher with a lick of sense tends to avoid it. Which I think is a tragedy, because in the avoidance, we miss some tremendous wisdom that is told to us through story. This cosmological story, as theologians call it, is a treasure trove of truth. A treasure trove of wisdom. Truth like this. God created human beings. He created them godlike, reflecting God's nature. God looked over everything that he had made. It was so good. So very good. I want to talk about that this morning. Created in the likeness of God. Created in the image of God. That's the way that it's often spoken. If you've been part of the faith journey for any length of time, you've heard those words before. You've heard in the telling and the retelling of the story this phrase so many times that perhaps it's no longer shocking to you. But it should be. Because the fact that you and I are created in the likeness and the image of God goes so directly against the instincts that we have been taught by our religion, it ought to scandalize us that it's in the book. It ought to scandalize us that we are made in the likeness of God and the image of God, because we have been taught some implications and some assumptions that go so contrary to that. And today, I want to come at a truth that we've been talking about in many ways over this since of January. But I want to come at it from a different angle. And I want to talk about our human identity again and how sin distorts our humanity, as we've done in these past lessons. But I want to do it by addressing a couple of terms that we haven't yet talked about, notably these two terms. One, total depravity, and the other, original sin. This would just be curious to me. How many people have heard the term total depravity before? Oh, so you know what I'm talking about. All right, that's good. Original sin, how many have heard of that one? Okay, I figured that one. And I want to look at these terms that are part of our Christian heritage through the lens of how we tell our story, particularly through the lens of what we are taught at the beginning of our story in Genesis 1. And I want to think about who we are, and I want to think about the implications of that for where we're going. Now, we've been talking a lot about theology these last few lessons. We talked about two views of God, the God of justice, the God of requirements and rewards, the God of justice and love. We talked about two views of humanity, one where we belong on the earth, one where we're just strangers passing through. We talked about several views of Jesus. We talked about how we tell the story of what it means that we are saved by Jesus. And I want to move from these theological, apple cart upsetting, poking people in the eye of their favorite theological norm. And I want to move from that to the spiritual journey. How we make application of these truths to a healthier, robust, vigorous spirituality. Because as I have said to you in so many times, Christian spirituality has grown ill now for several generations. We see it in the way Christian people are living. Very little different than the way the world is living, and it isn't working for us. We're not being transformed into the likeness of our God by the practices that we have, or the assumptions that we have picked up along the way. So, how do we move into a healthier spirituality? I want to talk about that on the basis of these theological points that I've been making in the last several lessons. So, let's go to this core text, created in the image of God. What this tells us is that we, in our created essence, we, in our essential nature, we reflect the very image, the very nature of the divine. It tells us that we are godlike in our true personalities, godlike in our true temperaments, godlike in our true character. Now, it is true that on top of that essential nature of who we are, there has been packed a whole bunch of baggage. Yes, we can't dismiss that reality. It's true. However, when we get down to the core of who we are, our story tells us. When we get down to the very essence of human nature, what we find is that we are made out of the same stuff God is made out of, if God were made out of anything. And if we believe that, boy, it would change everything. I was reading a guy who was writing on this particular subject, and he said, if I had ever believed that, it would have saved me thousands of dollars in therapy. Now here, our ancient cosmological poem tells us this, that your family of origin is divine. Unlike so much of what church teaching has given you, our very core, you are original blessing, not original sin. This story tells us that our origins are totally positive, that we are in essence, at the very core of who we essentially are, we are very good. So very good. God has proclaimed that over us. It also points us to our future. It tells us that we have somewhere good to come home to. It tells us that when we return to our essential selves, that when we finally come home to our true selves, it is a good place, it is a safe place, that it is well with our souls. And since the beginning was so right, the rest of the journey becomes considerably easier. It's simply a matter of returning to what already is. Returning to what is already our essential selves. Now, every summer, I have my kids. They're those fine-looking boys, aren't they? I have my kids read a book. Now, Haven has graduated from the Hammock School of Character. When she graduated, we woke her up on the morning she was going to head off to college. We woke her up, shook her awake. We turned on the stereo as loud as we could, pomp and circumstance. I had ordered this fancy cover, diploma cover, and opened up, and there was a diploma. She has graduated from the Hammock School of Character. She doesn't have to read those books anymore. But the boys, they still do. Sometimes it'll be a book about financial responsibility they have to read every summer. Sometimes it's a novel, usually something that points to character, often a biography, something that will inspire them to be men of character. Well, this year I had them do something a little bit different. This year I had them collaborate together on a project and give to me a timeline of the Bible from Abraham through to Jesus. So I had them break down all the major parts of the story, and I had them write a single-page description of each of the major characters or each of the major time periods from the time of Abraham all the way through to the time of Jesus. And then I had them take each one of these single-page reports that they had done on that time period and tape them together in sequence and tape them into a manila folder so they would fold into accordion style so that when we spread them out, they went across the whole dining room table with the extension in it and they looped over the chair and over the chair. It was quite a long piece of paper, a long project. And in them, I had them start with Abraham and then put all the essential things that happened during Abraham's life, and then Isaac, and then Jacob, and then the boys, and then Joseph, particularly of the boys, then the slavery, and then the Moses, and then the wilderness, and then Canaan, and then all the way into the judges, and then the kings, and then into the split kingdom, and then the captivities, and then all the way up to the Roman oppression, all the way through, told them from beginning to end. And then I had them tell back the story to me after we laid it out. And so we spent a couple of hours at the end of their project having them tell me the story. And as I typically do, I said, "So now why do you think I had you tell this story?" And they would say, "Well, because of this." And I'd say, "No." And then I would say, "So why do you think I had you do this project?" And they would tell me what they thought was the reason. "No, that's not it either." And kept going back until we finally got to the place where I could tell them, "Here's why I had you do this project." Because I wanted them to know how the parts of the story that they've heard all their lives, the different stories, connect to one another, and so that they could flow in one continuous story about the children of this one guy, this one character named Abraham, and how his children throughout all of this time had been seeking for God and had been looking for the experience of the divine, and how they had, through all of their upheaval and all of their upset, got closer and closer and closer to an accurate experience of the divine. And then I wanted them to be able to tell them, which I was pretty sure they wouldn't know, the point of the whole story. Through the various episodes that are told, through the sermons that are preached to people who were facing all kinds of calamitous situations, through all the revelations that people experience and find during their life struggles, the whole story points in this singular direction, that the fundamental objective of our religion is to help us return to the essential unity with God that defines our nature. It's to get back to what was told to us at the beginning, that you are created in the image of God. The objective of all of these episodes, all of these stories, all the teachings of the prophets, all the teachings of Jesus, is to get us to the place where we come and recognize that we are created in the very likeness, image of God. Now, we come from a heritage heavily influenced by Europe. And the European reformers did a lot to help us see some really great parts of our story. But despite all the wonderful things they helped us see, they had a very negative view of the essential nature of our humanity. Calvin was where you got that term, total depravity. He's the one who suggested that this was the nature of our humanity. And what a shame that those European reformers saw themselves and saw humanity and saw us as totally depraved, totally corrupt, totally wicked, and totally perverted. What a tragic starting place for people who are, in truth, created with such glory, created in the very likeness of God. What a tragic starting place for people who were invested in their very nature with such wondrousness, such God-likeness. And the Reformers' tragic disregard for this core truth 500 years ago has had far-reaching implications for Western Christianity. For a long time, this little nugget of total depravity kind of lay under the surface, and it was eclipsed by other things that the Reformers got so right. They got right the sanctity of the human. They got right the ability to find God directly and not have to go through a hierarchy or through an institution. They got right the deep respect for faith, for that trait opens to us the journey into the divine process. They got right the importance of the individual, which in turn led to a focus on human rights, which in turn led to universal education, which in turn led to the abolition of slavery, which in turn led to care for people and the development of hospitals and advancements in medical care. They got so many things right. But eventually this little nugget, this landmine that was sitting under the surface, began to taint the glories of the newfound reform. And in our lives and in our times, the self-hatred that so often characterizes the Christian church, the brittle and dogmatic intolerance that we see so much in Christian circles, often comes from that little landmine going off and telling us that we are totally depraved. It comes from ignoring the Genesis account. It comes from ignoring that part of our story. Now, in Europe, for the last 75 years, people have been disregarding Christianity in droves. And now the same, this many years later, is happening in our own nation. Because when we began to believe that we were totally depraved, in many ways, we have become totally depraved. And what happens is the Christian life and the Christian walk is producing people who live in ways that are so contrary to the life and to the spirit of Jesus. We have become what the reformers suggested might be true. So many Western Christians have missed this very important part of our story that it seems that they don't know, that we don't know, that at the core our souls are one with God, that union with God is our very being. Listen to how one of Jesus' disciples, talked about it after he'd had some time to reflect on it from 1 John 3. Here's John writing, says, "How great is the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. Dear friends, we are already the children of God. Only what we will be in the future has not yet been revealed. All we know is that when he appears, when all is revealed, we shall be like him." It's in our very genetics to be like God. Our journey of salvation is simply a journey of returning to what is already true about us. We are the children of God, born of the same nature as God.